I'm Beth Pariseau, senior news writer at TechTarget, and this is IT Ops Query Season 1, Tech's Tragedy of the Commons. Adam Jacob is CEO and co-founder of System Initiative, an infrastructure automation software startup that came out of stealth in 2023. Previously, he was co-founder and CTO of Chef Software, which also focused on infrastructure automation and was sold to Progress Software in 2020. Chef had roots in open source and underwent a license change in 2019. Jacob has taken a different tack with his new company. Welcome, Adam. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what happened at Chef with open source and how that's influenced your approach with System Initiative.
Yeah. I mean, a lot happened at Chef over like 15 years with open source. I think the arc that is most interesting is that, you know, when we started out with that company, what the model was that the Chef client, the thing you ran that configured your servers, was open source. And then the Chef server was as well. And what we were going to do was run like a hosted SaaS. And that was how we were going to monetize. We were way too early for a hosted configuration management platform. Like, no one wanted that except for very small sort of hobbyist folks. And so we drifted more into sort of open core. So for a while, we had two different versions of the Chef server. There was the open source one, and then there was a proprietary one that was what was running our SaaS that was written in Erlang. Then eventually that proprietary service was open sourced as well. And then we were just selling basically analytics and data about your Chef environment. And then we added more products to the suite. Those also sort of had some mix of open core. And then as we got larger and the market got a little more saturated and we sort of had lots more ARR than we did in the beginning, the difficulty in converting the remaining folks got pretty hard. We got one very famous in my mind, but probably not for normal people. Email was from a really large technology vendor. We'd done like a year-long bake-off against the competitors. Uh-huh. They sent us this email that was like, congratulations, you've won this deal, and we're never going to pay you because your business model is stupid. Oh. Love us. And I'm, you know, paraphrasing a little, not a lot, you know? It was pretty blunt. And so it was clear that the way that we were monetizing things was wrong. And the core of that issue was that we were making a free distribution that was the huge core value of Chef. The most valuable thing Chef did was configure your servers for you. I gave you an enterprise-grade product that was supported, had an incredible supply chain, had tons of engineers against it, all that stuff, and I gave it to you for free, for $0, not free as in speech, free as in beer. And then I was like, hey, but I'm gonna try to claw back some of that value by selling you something else on top of it. That's gonna work out pretty good. And it did. So like, I'm not complaining. Chef was a pretty big business. Most people would be thrilled if they got their business to the size of what Chef was. But we eventually changed our model so that we stopped building that free distribution. So we said the community could build one if they wanted to and give that away for free. But what we built was that distribution for people who wanted Chef and then had a generous free tier. That same customer who sent us that email converted like 2 days later after making that statement because we were no longer giving them the metaphorical milk for free.
Huh.
And it made a big difference in both how that business worked and how it felt. I think the community we had built around Chef, though, which was a big thriving thing, people loved Chef, people loved the community we'd built around it and had contributed a lot to it, felt a little betrayed because the Chef that they had been contributing to was the one that they were getting for free, right?
Right.
And so the fact that we were no longer doing that under the brand name Chef felt like a betrayal to them, which I understand. Yeah, it was complicated.
Okay, you're starting another company.
Yeah.
So what are you doing this time? How have you learned from the Chef experience and what are you doing now?
Yeah, I mean, when we started System Initiative, we weren't sure if it would be open source or not.
Okay.
In the end, it is. And the model we're following is the model Chef followed at the end. So essentially what we do is all the software is open source. There won't be any proprietary software that we build other than like our internal build systems and some of those things. But that's not really proprietary. That's just stuff we're not sharing. But what we do is say, look, only System Initiative can build System Initiative. We're the only ones who can produce that product under that trademark with that brand with those terms of service. Mm-hmm. That software is completely open source. If people want to take it and build their own distributions, they're totally free to. And we'd love to collaborate with them in System Initiative as the upstream. And they're free to do with that software whatever they want to do. If they want to start a business, if they want to do, they can do anything they want to do with it.
Right.
They can't do is call it System Initiative.
Mm.
They just can't say it comes from me. And then we sell that product for money. We sell it under commercial terms as an enterprise grade SaaS. We're going to sell it as on-prem software if that's how people want to vend it. Whatever it is they want to do, they can buy from System Initiative.
Along those lines, there does seem to be at least the perception of a catch-22 that you have to have that completely free as in beer open source software to get any traction, but then you end up doing the bait and switch. So how's that been working out for the company so far? And do you think that things will change about that idea?
Yeah, I mean, we're still quite small. So the software is only now starting to be ready for real people to use it in production. So It's a little early for me to report back on like how good it's doing, you know?
Right, yeah.
Proprietary software has a pretty long history in reaching its market. And when you look at how to run a business and you think about how do I look at my market? How do I understand who the different people are inside my market? How do those different people value whatever the product is that I produce? They value it differently. So if I'm a software developer who's very early using System Initiative, I'm going to value it differently than if I'm CTO at Morgan Stanley. They're two very different people, and they value what we provide very differently because their context varies widely. So in business, we call that price discrimination. I didn't make up the word, but that's what you call it.
Mm-hmm.
So you figure out how to slice the product up in ways that make it so the price that one person pays for the value is different than the price another person pays because the actual value they receive for it is different. And you try to find some vector in which that's true. So this is what OpenCore is doing too, right? They're saying, well, we don't monetize the people who don't care about analytics.
Right.
But we do monetize people who do care about analytics because that tends to be big companies who care more about it. So when we think about how you grow, one of the things about being in control of your own pricing is that you're also in control of free. You can absolutely say you can just use it and you can set the terms under which using it is allowed. There's nothing that stops you from doing any of those things. What you are doing is saying which part of the market is the part of the market that I want and I'm serving with my product. With System Initiative, I'm serving the head of that market. I'm building this thing explicitly so that people who are using it in business will pay me money for it.
Right.
Not that I don't also want everybody else to use it. I super do. But that's the business I'm building. That leaves a lot of space for other people to decide to do things that they want to do. And we can do that together. And so I can use very traditional looking price discrimination to decide, well, do I want those people to come and use System Initiative with a big free tier? How big? And I can measure that. I can look at what the cost to produce it is. I can look at the cost of conversion on the other side, and I can balance those scales. It's just business.
Mm-hmm.
Frequently, we don't do that when we start open source businesses. I certainly didn't know how to do that when I started Chef. I was just like,
right.
It's Apache licensed. Ah! And like,
yeah.
Away you go, right?
Yeah.
And so part of the education gap here, I think, is just, it's not like you get business school lessons.
True.
When you decide to start these things.
This is true.
You're sort of thrown into it. And so, you know, you talked about bait and switch a little bit.
Yeah.
The reason that bait and switch happens is because the market conditions change. Or market saturation happens, you know, you're HashiCorp, you're pretty big, competition gets bigger, growth slows down a little bit, even just a little, doesn't have to be big. And then you look at that huge amount of people that use the software and pay you nothing.
Yeah.
And you wonder, wouldn't it be great to convert 10% of them?
Hmm.
Even if I lost 80% of them, I don't really care. Because at some point I've reached enough saturation in the target market that's actually paying me that like,
yeah.
That's what I care about. And so we've sort of misaligned the incentives in that case. The actual price for the product is probably a little too low relative to the value that its customers are getting. And so we bait and switch because the business model's not working and you feel like you have to. So figuring out how do we explain to people how to align the incentives between their business and the open source part of what they do is sort of the way out of that trap.
Right. So that's the open product conversation. But there's also a separate one that revolves around things like Log4j and the Log4Shell issue of the low-level open source libraries that everybody uses and nobody pays for.
Yeah.
That legendary XKCD diagram of the world on a pin maintained by one guy in Nebraska.
Sure.
How do you see that conversation playing out as far as generally open source sustainability? And do you see it as at all related to this?
I don't think it's actually related to it. And,
right.
I think separating them is important because often we do conflate them. So we just say open source sustainability and people are like, well, the real problem is we're not paying the maintainers. And then other people are like, the real problem is my business is going to die. And then other people are like, the real problem is you bait and switched me. Like everybody sort of under the same banner is arguing about like five very different activities. And so I think thinking about sustainability of something like, you know, OpenSSL or Log4j or whatever, the questions there are more around how do we figure out how to put those software together in homes that can provide some level of sustainable funding. And so I think, you know, you've got things like Open Collective, you have things like the CNCF or the Linux Foundation or Apache or all these sorts of homes where like Apache doesn't do a ton of fundraising. But the moral equivalent here is that we're agreeing that this thing is important. We're agreeing that we're all going to work together on it. We're agreeing that we need some degree of resourcing to make that happen. Frequently, people will build things that are really useful, but that aren't really products. And they'll be like, no one's paying me to build this useful thing that isn't a product. And it's like, well, yeah, which is sort of a bummer. I'm not really sure how to solve for that. Because the only way I know how to solve for it is to build products, which I don't think is a good answer for everyone. Because I don't know how you turn Log4j into a product.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you have to. It's just also...
I don't think you have to either. But
what do we do about things like the fact that the OpenSSF, one of those homes as you describe it, has been trying to get $150 million fundraising for software security and open source for things that are lower level libraries and hasn't gotten close?
Let's just say $150 million fundraising with no upside ever is a tough sled. When you think about it as philanthropy and you go, okay, I'm a person of wealth and means, or I'm a company of wealth and means, and the question is, where do I put my money and under what terms? People tend to give money to things where they understand or have a personal connection to the output. This is why when you see the commercials for kids in Africa you could sponsor, they show you their names. They're like, this is Bobby. Because what you want is the idea that it's not a random person. It's this family. I'm giving money to these people. This is what's happening. You know, it's pretty abstract to say, hey, let's do a bunch of philanthropy for vaguely internet security to pay the maintainers. It's not because it's not noble. Like, it's obviously noble and necessary, but it's kind of unsurprising it's not working out the way we think it would, because it's not like we're saying pay Dave. If the question is, here is this maintainer, this individual who's doing this incredible work, let's pay them, I think it'd probably be easier to fundraise for that than to say, here's $150 million broadly for internet security. Trust us, we'll figure out how to distribute the money. It's pretty abstract.
Okay, that's fair. It's just, I guess the other upside to the more general internet security thing is we don't have disastrous supply chain security attacks. But does that fall into selling insurance?
What we're saying there is we're going to create a more trusted upstream that it's going to do the work that enterprise product companies need to do in order to ensure that their supply chain is safe. So like if you bought stuff from Red Hat, and Log4j happened, what they did was patch Log4j. And they did it everywhere. And that's why you paid them. Which doesn't mean that it wouldn't have been great to have Log4j not have that bug.
Right.
Of course it would have been. Tautologically fantastic. And also, we kind of do realize how that can be funded through a downstream that whose job is to take that thing that on its own isn't a viable product and turn it into one. At which point they make plenty of money, which then allows them to do the right thing for their customers because they're consumers of that thing. I'm not saying it's healthy. I'm just saying the dynamics are understandable. And it's unclear to me how you would translate that into saying, here's this other entity whose job is to create this trusted upstream. I'm not sure how they do that, because if I have two people working on a thing, what I'm basically saying is those two people need to be reliable over the long term in this way that so that I can consume it in a way that's like safe and secure and repeatable, doesn't break backwards compatible. There's all these guarantees that I want. I don't know how those people would give me those guarantees in a way that I would trust them. If you really boil it all the way down to saying, well, yeah, the incentive is that whatever, they're good people. Or you're like, what happens if they don't do it? Do we fire them? If there's a bug in Log4j, do we kick them to the curb? We're like, oh, sorry, no more money for you. You failed in your enterprise commitments. I don't think so. That doesn't make any sense. But I definitely fire Red Hat, right? Red Hat leaves me unpatched for a year. I'm like, you know? So like, there's a lot of really difficult, it's a very difficult conundrum. And I'm not sure I understand or see how like a conglomerate does that. Well, I find that side of the house much harder to deal with than the business side.
Okay. So to get back to the open product discussion, what do you think that the industry can do from here, aside from waiting for a new generation of followers that has learned from the lessons of the previous one? Is there anything else the industry can do to improve that situation?
Yes and no. I think one thing we need to do is we need to start talking about it as a business problem. And usually we talk about it as both an open source philosophy and morality problem, while also talking about it as a business problem. You kind of have to divorce the two, which doesn't mean that I'm giving up my open source morals or beliefs. I'm not. But if what I have is a business that needs to be a good business and the dynamics aren't set up for it to be one, I mean, that's a problem you're going to have to solve regardless of how you feel about open source. And I think as an industry, we haven't really done a very good job of explaining those dynamics. DevOps fell into this trap of saying, like, it's all about culture and not about tools. Open source business falls into this trap when we say open source isn't a business model, which is true as a sentence. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true. It's not a business model. And as soon as we say that, what we're really saying is that part's on you. You figure it out, bro. Like, there's all these business dynamics, but we don't teach you how to do that. We don't talk about what those things are. We don't talk about how to measure it. We don't talk about the impacts. We don't talk about the various dynamics and strategies that you need to employ. We don't do any of that for people. There's no resource for it. There's nowhere you can look. It doesn't exist. And the people who do talk about it are all talking about it from a perspective of essentially one. Here's what my company did, which isn't wrong. I'm doing the same thing to a degree. I just happen to have experienced all the variations of the model in like a weird speed run. But like in the end, the number one thing the industry could do is actually talk about those dynamics and have a conversation about those dynamics as business dynamics, as opposed to as open source dynamics. And if we did that, I think we could help solve that question of, well, how do I set these businesses up so that they can have those incentives be aligned over the long term, so that they don't wind up needing to rug pull when the market gets saturated or when growth slows down. But we're not doing it. And until we do, we're going to see more rug pulls and we're going to see more license changes because those business dynamics are real and it just is what it is.
Why do you think we're not doing it? Is it a cultural issue?
It's a lot you have to know to be able to have that conversation. If you think about open source in particular, if you ask a developer, do you understand open source? If there were 100 developers on this podcast right now, they would all say yes, because they've all used open source. They've all used GitHub. They've all done the thing. If you actually then say, okay, what are the three levers, business levers, legal levers that make open source work and how do you apply them? I don't think most people could give me all three. And the answer is copyright, trademarks, and patents. But how many people would even give you that answer? And then you break that down and go, okay, what are the dynamics of all the different ways you could apply licensing to those three different levers? And how would they change the dynamics of how people consume the software in your business? Even smaller answer. And then you go, okay, how many of you could even model a business, even at the highest level, the way that you would do it if you were taking an MBA course and it was the first quarter and they were just like, how do you measure the total addressable market of your business? Even smaller. So like shrinky. You get all the way to the bottom and you got to be like a weird niche lawyer who understands this really strange niche piece of law. You got to be a person who also understands business well enough to have a conversation with a CFO about what the model would be and what the strategy would look like. And then you have to be able to articulate both of those things while not violating a huge number of unspoken community norms. It's just a hard problem.
Yeah.
I think that's why we're not doing it, because the number of people who can is just vanishingly low. And then once you succeed, you don't need to. You know, maybe Mitchell from HashiCorp understood all these dynamics, but like Mitchell's very happy right now.
Sure.
Not doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah. Like there has to be some intrinsic motivation at some point to do it.
Right. I mean, I know we're not going to solve this issue here today, but is there a role for the CNCF in that discussion? Is there a way forward that you see right now?
One of the dynamics that's hard with the CNCF is that they have a sweet spot, which is software that's necessary and can be built by a large consortium of industry can thrive into their model. So they're essentially taking the software, pooling it together, pooling everyone's resources to push that technology into the market in a way that would allow everyone else to benefit from it downstream. Mm-hmm. That strategic mold and startups is kind of tough, because the dream there would be you give it to the CNCF. The CNCF then helps you get a bunch more marketing eyeballs and people looking at your software, which then allows you a bigger base to convert. The price you're converting from is still $0. And it turns out that huge vendors are great at undercutting you on price. So I might not be able to build a startup on a $0 base, but Amazon definitely can. And AWS definitely can. Microsoft definitely can. And so the people who reap the most benefit tends to be people who are much larger than small. And we sort of see that across the spectrum. So when I think about what role they can play, there may be a role they can play, but it would look very different than the role they play today. The role they play today is as clearinghouse and collaboration point for a bunch of complex software. If that's the role they need to play and continue to play, I don't know how they help solve this problem. There may be another shape that we haven't even considered that they could play. I don't know what that is, but I wouldn't count them out. But I don't think it's because they, as a foundation, they're like, well, let us still be this clearinghouse for the $0 enterprise distribution of the software you sank millions of dollars of venture capital into, but give away for free to a bunch of eyeballs in the hope that you're going to monetize it as a low ASP. That's a losing bet.
And hey, I mean, maybe that's just the way it goes. You know, companies don't have to live forever. Failure can be a teacher.
I mean, we can be better. I didn't think about any of this stuff when I started Chef. I didn't even know to think about it. How possibly could I? And it wasn't because there weren't open source businesses that had come before me. There were. Even those people, I'm not sure that they wound up considering it very deeply. Because when it works, it works. When open source works, it creates so much top of funnel that it papers over a lot of sins.
Yeah.
And so we just don't talk about it enough in a way to think, is there a business there that's sustainable long term if their model was different? I think there's a lot more businesses whose open source software and the business that they built would be sustainable if their model was different, but that aren't because their model wasn't different. But now that they've committed to those choices and made those bets, how you rotate into a version that is, oof.
Yeah. I mean, I guess everything's just history repeating on a certain level, but it does seem like there's a growing overall consciousness about this problem right now. I mean, that's kind of why you and I are talking.
Yeah. And I think that should give everyone hope. That we can start having a conversation that does lead to some more proactive solutions. I think this sounds trite, but ultimately you have to actually listen to the different people who have different points of view. If you're just mad about rug pulls and then you don't listen to the people who rug pulled about why they did it, it's going to be pretty difficult to come up with a strategy that helps other people avoid rug pulls in the future. Regardless of how I feel about any given business decision or piece of software, I need to understand it so that I can talk about how to not do it. Or understand if there isn't a way not to. Maybe they're right. I don't think they are, but I get it. As an industry, that conversation has to happen and we have to figure it out and then we have to talk about it. But it has to be of a different shape than I think it is now.
Okay, I think that's a good place to leave off. I know you and I both could talk about this for another few hours. But
oh, yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's good for podcast purposes and I thank you for joining me in this new venture.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
This has been ITOps Query Season 1, Tech Strategy of the Commons. If you have any feedback on this episode or want to share questions or stories we should consider covering, please reach out to me at bpariso, that's B as in boy, P as in Peter, A, R, I, S as in Samuel, E, A, U, at techtarget.com. Please also consider rating, reviewing, or subscribing to this podcast on your platform of choice. And tune in next week for our continued conversations with industry experts about open source principles and sustainability. Thank you for being with us so far.